the called America's Worst Case Scenario, has also entered into the express lane, particularly after the severe sanctions imposed by the U.S. and its European vassals on Russia following the Ukrainian war, which have effectively cut Russia off from the West and have accelerated Russia's strategic reorientation towards Asia and the global South. Thank you for joining us on this episode. Until the next time on Insight.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight. China plans to warmly invite Taiwan back into its arms. The Chinese acted with soft power by increasing trade and tourism between the two countries. A soft power approach amounts to persuading the Taiwanese people that there is no reason to fear reunification with the motherland. We now present you an article written by Mohammad Reza Jofar, an expert in geopolitics. The piece is titled Soft Power, China's Strategy for Taiwan. The geostrategic atmosphere in the South China Sea has been tense following the recent visit to Taiwan by U.S. House of Representatives Speaker Nancy Pelosi. This brought to the fore the issue of China's marine embargo and Beijing's need to access strategic straits in East Asia, which have been traditionally controlled by allies of the U.S., including Japan, the Philippines, and Indonesia. China's eastern and northeastern ports are limited to marine routes that go through the Sea of Japan and the East China Sea. On the south and southeast, Chinese ships have to cross the Malacca and Sunda Straits in the Philippines and Indonesia to access international waters. Therefore, Beijing attaches great importance to facilitating the transit of its ships, and the possible escalation of tension between China and these countries over marine routes has been a subject of discussion by experts in geopolitics over the past two decades. There is an archipelago between China and the Pacific Ocean, which Beijing calls the first island chain that falls within the limits of its territory. China's relations with its neighbors have been damaged over the ownership of more than 200 small coral islands. These sea passages provide access to some of the world's most important shipping routes through the South China Sea. China is trying to gain control of all these passages because it fears that at a time of heightened tensions, it may lose access to them. Japan has been a major impediment to China's free access to the Pacific Ocean. A look at the existing sea routes shows that when Chinese ships leave the Yellow Sea and circle the Korean Peninsula, they have to cross the Sea of Japan and La Perouse Strait before gaining access to the Pacific Ocean. Most of this area falls within the marine territories of Japan or Russia and may be close to China in times of heightened tension. Even if the Chinese cross the strait, they must still go through the Kuril Islands to the northeast of Hokkaido, which are collectively controlled by Russia but claimed by Japan. Although China and Japan have many border disputes, their row over La Perouse Strait is the most important one, which restricts China's shipping in the northern and eastern waters of the country. Taiwan, whose official name is the Republic of China, is also known as the Chinese Taipei, National China, and Formosa. It is a region in East Asia comprised of the islands of Taiwan, Penghu, Kinmen, Matsu, and a number of other small islands. All of them are located off China's eastern coast. Via its sea borders, this island nation neighbors the People's Republic of China on the west, Japan on the northeast, and the Philippines on the south. Taiwan is located below Okinawa in the South China Sea and is away from mainland China. Chinese officials consider it as their country's 23rd province. However, it is currently an ally of the United States, and its naval and air forces are equipped with American weaponry. Taiwan went under China's ownership in the 17th century. According to the Taiwan Relations Act of 1979, the United States is committed to defending Taiwan in case of a Chinese attack. However, this will not be the case if Taiwan declares its separation from the mainland, as a secessionist policy by Taiwan is considered a major provocation and will be deemed an act of war by China. Both governments strive to gain official recognition for themselves, and it is Beijing that has been mostly successful in this regard. With a population of 1.4 billion against Taiwan's 23 million, China enjoys more power of persuasion and geopolitical clout than Taiwan. The Chinese do not want Taiwan to be able to vie militarily with Beijing. Instead, they have acted with soft power by increasing trade and tourism between the two countries. China plans to warmly invite Taiwan back into its arms. A soft war approach amounts to persuading the Taiwanese people that there is no reason to fear reunification with the motherland. China's general policy is to try to maintain good relations with most of its bordering countries, so as not to allow any separation movement to be organized or supported. What is certain is that China will never let go of Taiwan due to geopolitical reasons, because Taiwan is both a commercial and an energy transit route, and a buffer zone for China against the Pacific Ocean. Also, it is not unlikely that China's failure to govern Taiwan will trigger widespread internal unrest that will threaten the Communist Party's influence and China's unity, because if the Chinese government accepts Taiwan's separation from the mainland, it is possible that the suburban and marginal areas would enter into a conflict with the central government in Beijing. This, in turn, would also bring the buffer zones into the conflict. Nevertheless, in a situation where China's military power is on the rise, Taiwan and the United States will show less desire for a military conflict. For Beijing, Taiwan is a small threat that can be managed. Now that China is the second largest economy in the world, it has a global advantage. Beijing has the initiative, and in the event of any sanctions or war, the United States will suffer more than any other country. While the European Union was the main victim of the sanctions regime against Russia, the situation is completely different in the case of China. Moreover, the international community will not be able to take the brunt of sanctions against China. China views Taiwan through a geopolitical security lens, and they would naturally assume that the Westerners are trying to harm China's security. However, China's security will not be compromised. Political geography and realities on the ground are against Taiwan's secessionist policy. It should be noted that China will not show much flexibility in the case of a blockade of the existing sea routes, such as the Sunda Strait, the Taiwan Strait, and the Malacca Strait, through which 80% of China's energy resources pass. In case such policies are implemented, an all-out crisis will occur in the South China Sea. Beijing intends to dissuade its neighbors from getting close to the United States and change the opinion and method of the United States as well. Therefore, it is investing in deep water ports in these regions, an investment that would bring China closer relations, trade connections, and the possibility of friendly bases in other countries for naval deployment. China considers Taiwan as a breakaway province that should be reunited with the mainland under the internationally recognized One China policy. Under that policy, nearly all countries recognize Beijing's sovereignty over the island, including the United States of America, which has no formal diplomatic ties with the territory. However, in violation of its own stated policy and in an attempt to irritate Beijing, Washington continues to court the secessionist government in Taipei, supporting its anti-China stance and supplying it with massive caches of armaments. In flaming tensions between the United States and China, the 82-year-old Nancy Pelosi stepped in Taiwan on 2nd of August, prompting Beijing to react to the highest-level U.S. visit to Taiwan in 25 years, with a burst of military activity in the island's surrounding waters. Recently, Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Wang Wenbin said at a press conference in Beijing that China would resolutely fight back against every U.S. provocative act that undermines its sovereignty and territorial integrity and meddles with its domestic affairs. Warning of the escalation in tensions, the Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Wang Wenbin said, "Pelosi's trip to Taiwan is a major political provocation to upgrade U.S.-Taiwan exchanges." Wenbin added, "It violates the commitment to maintaining only unofficial exchanges with Taiwan made by the United States in the communique on the establishment of diplomatic relations between China and the United States, violates the One China principle widely recognized by the international community and confirmed by the United Nations General Assembly's Resolution 2758, and violates the norms of international law of non-interference in internal affairs established by the United Nations Charter." The Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Wang Wenbin said, Beijing had warned Washington well in advance against Nancy Pelosi's visit to Taiwan, and that such a trip would cause a crisis and major disruption to China-US exchanges and cooperation. The spokesman said the US side is going further down the path of hollowing out and distorting the One China principle, but it accuses China of changing the status quo. The United States conducts up to 100 military exercises in China's surrounding waters every year, but accuses China of overreacting. China will not accept this thuggish logic, nor will the international community. The Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman, Wang Wenbin, also noted that every time the American side makes a serious provocative act of infringing on China's sovereignty and interfering in China's internal affairs, the Chinese side will resolutely fight back. China will never allow its sovereignty and territorial integrity to be wantonly trampled upon and sabotaged.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
How many wars is the United States fighting right now? Well, the answer is zero, as under the Constitution, Congress must declare war, and the last countries that Congress declared war on were Bulgaria, Romania, and Hungary in 1942. 8 decades and what seems to be zero wars. Any countries with such a record must be one of the most peaceful places on earth. But as history has shown, this is not the case with the US, as it is fighting and has waged wars on many countries across the world. It just doesn't want to call them wars. Over the last 20 years, the US has dropped an average of 46 bombs and missiles on other countries each day. And now, a new study has revealed that more than a quarter of the 400 wars which the US has sugarcoated in terms such as a military-led operation, police actions, or humanitarian interventions have taken place in West Asia and Africa. So it seems that as Americans struggle to address urgent needs at home, their governments have committed them to endless wars in an attempt to support what seems to be one of the key pillars of the US, the military-industrial complex.
The US has tried to be on the first hand with an image of also being seen as a global policeman, which came and, of course, as some have argued, it's done more harm than good. When you look into the global dominance and production of all these weapons and also use of it in terms of interventions, you see a situation whereby US wants to be the first, to be seen the most powerful nation in the world, to be seen as the one that can intervene and maybe make a difference, whichever difference whose interest it serves. Of course, they will have to define that. It's a bit a gray area. You cannot define it very clearly.
The world seems to have entered a new era after the Second World War, one where relations between countries has been at a much more stable and peaceful state. But while the decline of war and the relative harmony among great powers is cause for celebration, the US seems to believe otherwise in light of its grand strategy and political powers that seem to be running its system, namely the military-industrial complex. The U.S. has constantly, since the Cold War, intervened in foreign affairs and engulfed itself in wars far from its borders, wars which in most cases seemed endless and even pointless at times. But while the U.S. military is swamped in conflicts in other countries, it's hard to see any end in sight, especially an end where it is the victor. A month into his presidency, Donald Trump said that the U.S. no longer wins wars as it once did. And the reason behind this might be the fact that the U.S. isn't necessarily in wars. It is, in fact, in foreign interventions where its presence has more often than not worsened the situation, further aggravating an already chaotic crisis. And all this may only be to support the thriving war business in the U.S. Big war CEOs say the chaos in the world has led to excellent prospects for them, while arms contractors say recent violence and tensions in the Ukraine conflict works in their shareholders' favor. And this leads to the questions that do war manufacturers and U.S. foreign policy go hand in hand in promoting wars?
You think about the terrorism happening within the Sahel region, and of course, U.S. is an intervention in power also. They have to do what they have to do, use of drones and all these things. So they are giving us another reason as well. But elsewhere, whether it's in East Africa, Somali intervention, this is also given a different recent campaign, war against terror. So there's always a reason being given. So therefore, war never looks like it's been manufactured or it's been planned, deliberately planned or calculated to maybe maximize sales of weapons. But truth be told, that whenever there's a conflict, weapons will always be used.
The U.S. Justice Department says FBI agents have found 11 sets of classified documents, with some marked as top secret, in Trump's Mar-a-Lago home in Florida while executing a search warrant this week. The warrant was publicly released following a federal judge's order. It states investigators had probable cause to believe Trump violated three federal crimes, including violating the Espionage Act, obstruction of justice, and criminal handling of the government records. Media reports say the FBI search of Trump's Mar-a-Lago home was for possible classified materials related to U.S. nuclear weapons. Trump, however, rejected that. He called it a hoax and claimed he had no stored classified information. The unprecedented raid on the residence of the former U.S. president provoked a backlash from leading Republicans who described the move as politically motivated. The Florida governor, Ron DeSantis, said the search of Trump's property was another escalation in the weaponization of federal agencies against the regime's political opponents. Also, Florida Senator Marco Rubio stated that Biden is using his power to persecute Trump. But the White House has denied the allegations, saying it was unaware of the search before it happened. Moreover, there have been growing threats in recent days against FBI agents and offices across the country. On Thursday, a man who tried to breach the FBI Cincinnati office was shot and killed by police after he fled the scene. Law enforcement officials say the man may have been present at the January 6th riot. Right after news of the FBI search of Mar-a-Lago broke, there was a big spike in tweets referencing civil war. Analysts and reporters say this is alarmingly similar to the activities in the lead-up to the January 6th attack on the Capitol.
Well, I think it's true that there are people in the permanent national security wing of the U.S. government who don't want Trump to return to office. And whether or not those people are currently raiding Trump in Mar-a-Lago in order to try to get proof of crimes they could use to charge him and put him in a position where he legally can't run for office.
Shockwaves spread across America in response to the news that the FBI had searched the private Florida residence of Donald Trump. It prompted threats of retaliation from the former U.S. president and his allies. The surge in violent rhetoric drew concerns that it could lead to civil unrest and a social crisis. Department of Homeland Security officials have been warning for months that this type of warlike rhetoric, which came to fruition on January 6th and which continues to be fueled by reactions to ongoing investigations of Trump, is increasing the risk of more widespread political violence ahead of the midterm elections in November. This comes as recent polls have shown a rising acceptance of political violence among Americans. About 1 in 3 Americans say they believe violence against the government can at times be justified. According to another study by researchers at the University of California Davis Violence Prevention Research Program and the California Violence Research Center released last month, more than half of Americans expect that a civil war will erupt in the U.S. sometime in the next few years.
I think it is a sign that the U.S. Polarization has gotten way out of hand and could be leading to a constitutional crisis and possible civil war or social breakdown kind of situation. We have seen this polarization growing for many years.
Meanwhile, as much as 40% of election and poll workers in the largest jurisdictions in the U.S. have so far said they won't be returning to their jobs out of their own fears. Other states are seeing drop-offs too. Nearly 1 in 3 local election workers said they felt unsafe because of their jobs. The alarming partisan divide within the U.S. political system ahead of the vital midterm elections in November had raised concerns over the possibility of internal conflict.
Tensions are still high between China and Taiwan. The flare-up comes days after the provocative visit by U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi to the island. Officials in Chinese Taipei have rejected the one-country, two-systems plan proposed by China for the self-ruled island. Taipei says that only the Taiwanese can decide the island's future. The reaction came after China published a white paper on Taiwan, which Beijing says shows the resolute determination of Beijing to peacefully resolve the unification issue. The paper lays out China's position on the self-ruled island. It says Beijing would never allow any attempt to separate Taiwan, but also would make every effort to achieve unification through peaceful means. Taiwan has accused Beijing of using House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's visit as, quote, an excuse to destroy the status quo. Pelosi visited the island on August 2nd, despite vehement protests from China.
What they want to do with Taiwan is fight, U.S. wants to fight China to the last Taiwanese. If not to the last Japanese, if not enough, then to the last Korean. Ultimately, the U.S. will not fight the wars. It will finance them. It will give weapons. It will antagonize us. It will antagonize both sides. And that's what they want to do. And it's actually a replica to the World War II.
Beijing reacted with an unprecedented burst of military around the island. The drills lasted for several days. Taiwan has also launched live fire drills in the wake of China's largest ever military exercises. The white paper issued by China this week was the third document of its kind over Taiwan. The previous editions were the Taiwan Question and Reunification of China, which was published in 1993, and the One China Principle and the Taiwan Question, which came out in 2000. China insists differences in the social systems in mainland and Taiwan are, quote, neither an obstacle to reunification nor a justification for secessionism. But Beijing says it will not rule out the military option to achieve such reunification.
What China wants to do with this white paper is just to find a way with Taiwan to get it back to its sense, because reunification will happen. The problem is that if it doesn't happen peacefully, it will happen by force. China doesn't want to do it by force, but it's being pushed on the corner by the U.S. because the U.S. is actually slowly declaring Taiwan independent.
Speaker Pelosi's controversial visit has undermined the One China policy, which is recognized by nearly all countries of the international community, including the United States. Under the policy, the international community recognizes Taiwan as part of China, and the U.S. is committed to recognizing and having formal ties with China rather than the island of Taiwan. But Washington, contrary to its stated policy, continues to undermine China's sovereignty and courts the secessionist government in Taipei.
So what is the one country, two system? It was applied actually the first time is in Hong Kong. And so since the handover in 1997, they applied the one country, two system. The way it was done in Hong Kong was that Hong Kong could keep its a very high degree of autonomy. And actually, they did it for Hong Kong, and it was a way, a showcase that could they could show to Taiwan to say, well, in case you were to reunify with the mainland, this would be the system.
China has proposed the one country, two systems model to win Taiwan back. The policy allowed the Chinese government to successfully solve the question of Hong Kong through diplomatic negotiations with the British government. Hong Kong was under colonial British rule since the 19th century. China resumed to exercise its sovereignty over the island on July 1, 1997.
But what happened in Hong Kong was that you had the external forces. You had a massive amount of money being poured by NED, National Endowment for Democracy, and you had the usual suspect, the whole team of regime change working for the US, the MI6, and they did everything to destroy the one country system in Hong Kong, and that ended up with the riots. And then in 2020, you had the national security law.
Under the model, offshore regions like Hong Kong remain under China's sovereignty but can retain their own economic and administrative systems. Now China insists the same model could be applied to Taiwan.
Iran is making giant leaps in its peaceful space program. Iran has just launched its Khayyam satellite into orbit. The satellite was sent into space from the Moscow-operated Baikonur Cosmodrome in Kazakhstan. Khayyam satellite was sent into orbit on Tuesday by Soyuz 2.1B rocket. Iran says it will also use imagery from Khayyam to monitor Iran's borders and improve the country's capabilities in management and planning in the fields of agriculture, natural resources, environment, mining, and natural disasters. After all, Iran is surrounded by US bases, and terrorists have preyed on Iran to enter its soil to conduct terrorist operations. Contrary to claims made by Western media outlets, Tehran insists the Khayyam satellite is fully controlled by Iranian experts and technicians based inside Iran from the very beginning of its launch. However, not everyone is happy about this satellite launch. The US expressed anger at Iran's partnership with Russia and accused Iran that the aim of the satellite is spying, something Iran has categorically rejected. The US has said they suspected that the satellite could be used by Moscow to spy on troop movements in Ukraine. Yet, Iran is resolute in its cooperation with Russia. It has said it will continue production of such satellites with Russia, adding that it's a great honor for Iranian technicians to work alongside Russian technicians who have more than six decades of experience in the field.
Yes, well, the US government, of course, is particularly concerned about this. It really, in many respects, it should have seen this coming. It should have seen cooperation between states that it has under attack coming. But the arrogance, I think, of the US in particular, of Washington in particular, blinds it to these sorts of developments. They could ignore the fact, for example, that small states like Syria, like Cuba, were able to cooperate together. But when large states like Iran and Russia cooperate together, there's the inevitability. There's going to be new developments which free those countries, those peoples, from the domination of the US.
The
The launch of Hayom satellite has been hailed as, quote, an important milestone in Russian-Iranian bilateral cooperation that paves the way for implementing new joint projects. It has ushered what Iran has dubbed as its strategic aerospace cooperation between Tehran and Moscow. Russia now says it's open to cooperation in the field of space exploration with all interested countries and partners, specifically Iran. The launch is also seen as a major achievement for Iran, despite Western sanctions.
Okay, so it's very important. The cooperation between Iran and Russia in satellite technology is very important because it shows a cooperation between large states with great capacity, which are both under economic blockade by Washington in particular. I would say Washington rather than the West, because really there are some mixed feelings in some parts of other Western countries. But certainly Washington is very jealous of any sort of independent achievement by Iran or Russia.
Iran says Western sanctions cannot stop its scientific progress. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi has said that the successful launch of this satellite is a great achievement for Iran. This comes as Iran has made significant achievements in the field of science and technology in recent years. Earlier this year, Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps Aerospace Force launched its second homegrown satellite into a low Earth orbit nearly 2 years after the launch of its first military satellite. The IRGC successfully put Nur 2 or Light 2 into orbit on March the 8th. Iran has already mastered the technology to build remote sensing satellites with an image resolution of 5 to 10 meters and can inject up to 50 kilogram packages into an orbit of 500 kilometers. But Hayom can hit a much more precise resolution of 1 meter. Iran aims to achieve the technology to put a 100-kilogram satellite into the 500-kilometer orbit by next year.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید. ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد میشید به حق تعالی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. As a reminder, you heard that Imam Khomeini authored the book Kashf al-Asrar in response to the misleading book 1000 Year Secrets, which had been written by Ali Akbar Hakamizadeh, an erstwhile student of seminary who left for the U.S. while no more wearing the costume of clergymen. It was said that Imam Khomeini's book can be considered as the starting point of his struggles against the Pahlavi regime and his endeavor to establish the Islamic rule. Today, we are going to dwell upon that part of the Imam's struggles which were against the Shah's so-called White Revolution. As usual, the narrator is mainly Imam Khomeini's wife, Ms. Khadija Saghafi. After the passing away of Grand Ayatollah Hossein Borujerdi in 1961, Iran's Shah, Mohammad Reza, thought that one of the main obstacles against his anti-religious moves and consolidation of his tyrannical rule had gone. Therefore, he started fighting off Islam and ulema very seriously and openly. However, his dream was very soon shattered by Imam Khomeini's uprising, which fell upon him like a nightmare. The Imam raised the banner of a struggle against the regime and its main supporter, the U.S., opening a new chapter in the political and religious atmosphere of the country. Imam Khomeini's wife narrates, "The Imam was a wise, clever, and religious man. After the demise of Ayatollah Burujerdi, he staged uprising against the Shah apparatus, which wanted to set aside religion and march in the path of the West. As he was a very religious and devoted person, whenever the religion and religiosity were mocked at, it was as if his children had been beheaded in front of him. After the late Burujerdi, the Shah intended to set aside clergymen and religion in Iran forever. Of course, he had made the decision at the time of late Burujerdi, but his power wouldn't let the Shah do such a thing. In those days, the man of politics and the field of a struggle against the regime was Ayatollah Kashani, and Mr. Khomeini was acquainted with him, but there was not a political relation in the modern sense, and, as I have said, the Imam's main job was studying and discussion." Imam Khomeini had a positive opinion on the struggles of Ayatollah Kashani, although he had some critical views too. The Imam's wife continues, "My father said that when Mr. Kashani had seen Mr. Ruhullah for the first time, he told my father, 'Where have you found this prodigy? He's a good base for the future.' Mr. Khomeini liked Mr. Kashani's struggles generally and would go to his house too. But it was not that much to say that he had a role in late Kashani's political establishment. After late Burujerdi, the Imam, besides studying and discussion, had become a source of emulation himself and considered himself responsible before events. Thus, he couldn't be silent against deviations and believed that silence against oppression is a bigger oppression. In the winter of 1963, the American President John F. Kennedy advised the Shah to implement the so-called reforms, calling it the White Revolution, or the Revolution of the Shah and the People. This measure comprised issues which were seemingly useful, such as land reforms, granting the right to vote to women, and giving shares of the profits of factories to workers. But the Shah's main aim was to bolster the foundation of his despotic rule and destroying strong social forces such as the clergymen and landowners." Ms. Saghafi says, "In 1963, the government decided to do some reforms. Although it was not that important, it implied issues which would make them important. The Imam believed that the Shah had taken the first step cautiously, but his next steps would be serious danger for Islam and the country's independence. Therefore, he couldn't be silent against the Shah anti-religious moves." Imam Khomeini's wife, Ms. Saghafi, referring to her protest to the Imam as why he was the only one among the ulema and sources of emulation to oppose the Shah's plan, says, "The Imam felt his duty in this regard and considered himself accountable before God. I told him, why do other ulema and sources of emulation not protest and it is only you who feel their duty? He answered, I don't bother them, lady. By God, I am responsible. If you are ready to see God punishing me on the judgment day, tell me to keep silent. So I was sure that the Imam had a mission which he had to fulfill. Therefore, I always try to pave the ground for his activity. Imam Khomeini's courageous and explicit opposition to the Shah's so-called referendum infuriated the latter, and there were rumors of arresting the Imam. Yet, Imam Khomeini was so calm and unmoved. Ms. Saghafi narrates as follows. The morning gatherings and narrations of Imam Hussein's tragedy were different from those of the previous years. Little by little, these narrations were finding their true meaning, which was the memory of martyrs and combatants of the path of freedom and religion. They had gradually changed from amusement and stupor to movement and awareness. Preachers had turned the issue from the state of stupor and would prepare the people for resistance against all tortures and torments. Preparation for uprising, the uprising like Hussein by his descendant Khomeini. When the rumor prevailed on Imam Khomeini's arrest, one night he told me, if they arrest me, do not be anxious. I told him jokingly, that's good as I will breathe for a while. In the advent of his struggles, the Imam would tell Ahmad, tonight they may arrest me, don't fear. If they come and arrest me, don't do anything. Don't seek help from anyone to relieve me. Even do not accept anyone's money for livelihood.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khomeini's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The following is a part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with Friday prayer leaders from across the country in the Imam Khomeini Husseiniyah on July 27, 2022. In the name of God, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Praise be to God, Lord of the worlds, and peace and blessings be upon our Master, Prophet Muhammad, and upon his pure progeny, particularly the remnant of God on the earth. I welcome you, gentlemen, my dear brothers, from across the country who are working in highly sensitive, important organization. I'm glad and thankful to God, and after several years, 2-3 years, I'm able to meet you in person. I take it as a good omen that this meeting is taking place during the days that belongs to the household of the Prophet ﷺ, from Eid al-Ghadir to the day of Mubahila. The revelation of Surah al-Insan and the verse of Wilaya, guardianship, and the blessings that exist in these days of this week. I hope, God willing, the Lord will guide us in the way of the Prophet and his household. Peace be upon them all. And God willing, we will be able to move in their path.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The day of Mubahala is a very important day. The day of Mubahala is the day of prophethood and the day of wilaya. The event of Mubahala is both proof of prophethood and proof of wilaya and imamate. For this reason, this day is very important. I hope that Almighty God will keep us steadfast on this blessed path. I'd also like to thank Mr. Haj Ali Akbari, both for his efforts and for the things he spoke about here. The issues that were mentioned were correct and good. I have prepared some items which I have written down to share with you, my dear brothers. One point is about the position that the Friday prayers hold, and we, as Friday prayer leaders, should realize the importance of this. When a person becomes aware of the importance of a job or a responsibility, he gives it priority over other tasks and pays more attention to all related aspects of it. We need to know this, and so do other people. The IRIB and our officials need to inform people that the Friday prayer is not merely a congregational prayer in a mosque. Rather, it is a great and important phenomenon in a city.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. I want to thank you for bringing me home.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio, with you every single moment.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Austria is famous for its stunning architecture and artistic legacy, boasting to be the home of the great German composers, including Mozart and Beethoven. Sadly, however, Austria has built up another reputation in recent years, that of growing intolerance towards its Muslim minority. According to data released in June 2022, over 1,000 Islamophobic incidents were reported the previous year, a shocking increase which has grown year upon year. Research into anti-Muslim hate crimes in Austria have found that the overwhelming majority of the incidents which take place has been men targeting women, with a staggering 69% of victims being female, many of whom wear the hijab. However, it's not just on the street level where the targeted harassment of Muslims is taking place. The sharp spike of 2021 was allegedly assisted by the controversial state-implemented Islam map, introduced by authorities to highlight the location of all mosques across Austria. Critics believe it aided in the spread of hate crimes. Press TV sat down with Iman Shaker, who's experienced firsthand what it's like to be a target of hate after she was almost physically assaulted for wearing a hijab.
I don't think you can name a single visibly Muslim person in this country that hasn't been verbally attacked or even physically. And I try to not give a lot of attention to the individual attacks I face, because that would just be, that would just be very...
Although it was hard to relive the experience, Iman doesn't believe in playing the victim, instead focusing on the root cause.
Focusing on a single perpetrator and focusing my anger towards him would be very weakening, in my opinion, because in the end he has fallen victim to the narrative that the state has given him about us being a threat.
In November 2020, Austrian authorities launched Operation Luxor, which saw homes and offices of Muslim charities and activists raided as part of a so-called war on political Islam. But critics claim its only achievement is dehumanizing Muslims and fueling growing public fear towards Islam. An increase in fear almost certainly leads to more hate. Robert Carter, Vienna.
Thousands of South Korean unionists and their progressive supporters rallied in downtown Seoul to protest against joint U.S.-South Korea war games planned for later this month. The drills will be the largest in years and follow the May election of President Yoon Suk-yeol, who's promised to take a hard line with North Korea. Union leaders worry about risks.
The threat of nuclear war is growing on the Korean Peninsula. Conservative forces of Yoon Suk-yeol in South Korea and those in the U.S. are frantically conducting aggressive war drills in the sky, the land and the sea, and are about to start large-scale joint military exercises aimed at the invasion of North Korea. We must stamp out this behavior of anti-reunification forces.
While many South Koreans, especially supporters of President Yoon on the right, favor close ties with the U.S., large numbers also argue the U.S. military and the country's alliance with Washington prevent the improvement of ties with North Korea and generate tension.
We not only oppose the war exercises, but we want the U.S. forces, Korea, which is actually controlling and interfering with the Korean Peninsula, to leave this land. We believe that only then will the 80 million Koreans from both North and South be able to live peacefully.
The drills will reportedly involve a U.S. aircraft carrier strike group with extensive field training to include amphibious maneuvers. South Korea has also been training alongside U.S. forces with recently acquired American F-35 Joint Strike Fighters. In an effort to strengthen the U.S.-South Korea alliance, military officials from Seoul and Washington will meet to discuss the deployment of U.S. strategic assets and extended deterrence, which refers to the deployment of U.S. nuclear weapons in the defense of South Korea. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Hundreds of pro-Palestine activists marched through central Vienna on Friday to vent their anger following Israel's recent bombardment of Gaza. They joined thousands of other protesters worldwide who were shocked into action after the three-day Israeli offensive left over 350 Palestinians wounded, 46 dead, including 16 children, according to Palestinian officials.
Following the recent violence against Gaza, shocking images of children suffering and dying went absolutely viral on social media. Yet despite these disturbing images doing the rounds, they haven't been routinely featured in Western mainstream media circles. In fact, it's incredibly rare for any images of Palestinian suffering to be published at all.
They are suffering every day, every single day. People got arrested, children got arrested, people got murdered. Gaza, what we saw last week in three, 4 days, got bombed. They have no electricity, they have no way to go anywhere. They are blocked from the Israeli occupation.
I need to tell my people that we are standing up for them. We are resisting from abroad. So you have to stay strong. And I'm an artist, so it is a duty for me to raise the voice for the ones who are not heard.
We need to raise our voice, and Austria cooperates with Israel, and that's what we are doing here also, is that we want to make people aware of this, that Austria is cooperating with Israel.
Despite regular condemnation of Israeli aggression by human rights groups, Palestinians continue to suffer while the Western world looks on, leaving few options left for Palestinians driven to fight for their very survival. Robert Carter, Vienna.
In mid-August last year, the Taliban took control